We did chapter 24. We're doing chapter 25. That's the last chapter of 2 Kings. Israel is in exile. Judah's on his way out the door. There is no Israel about to be left. But God never loses sight. Alrighty. There's going to be a bunch of names in here that I'm probably just going to call Bill and Bob. So, just as a warning. Now, in the ninth year of his reign, which is actually 588 BC, just to give you a frame of reference, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his army, against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall all around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. Here's what Jeremiah had to say about it. Exact same thing written in Jeremiah. And this is the cool part, because Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Daniel, all this stuff is all right around here. This is all stuff, the exile stuff with Israel and with Judah. So if you want to get a frame of reference of when those books were written, because they seem like separate accounts, but they're all this, and it all intertwines. Here's what Jeremiah had to say about what we just said here. Meanwhile, Pharaoh's army had sent out from Egypt, and the Chaldeans, who had been besieging Jerusalem, heard and reported about them. They lifted the siege from Jerusalem. Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, saying, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, thus you are to say to the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of me, behold, Pharaoh's army, which has come out for your assistance, is going to return to the land of Egypt." If you were wondering why Zedekiah would ever defy Nebuchadnezzar, that seems awful stupid. You know, like, dude, what are you doing? Well, he thinks Egypt's coming to save him. And that's what Jeremiah's telling you. This is why he didn't do what Nebuchadnezzar told him to do, and he just thumbed his nose at him. But Jeremiah shows up. He sends Jeremiah and says, "Tell me what the Lord says," and this is what he's telling him. He says, "Thus said the Lord of Israel, thus you are to say to the king of Judah, who sent me to inquire you, behold, Pharaoh's army, which has come for your assistance, is going to return to its own land of Egypt. The Chaldeans will also return and fight against this city. They will capture it and burn it with fire. Thus says the Lord, do not deceive yourself, saying the Chaldeans will surely go away from us, for they will not. Even if you had defeated the entire army of the Chaldeans who were fighting against you, and there were only wounded men left among them, each man in his tent, they would rise up and burn the city with fire." What he's saying is, it don't matter what you do. You can go out there and defeat that entire army, and there could be three crippled guys left. They're going to come in and burn your city. Because they're not doing it, I'm doing it. And yeah. Why do we call for Jeremiah? That's where, you know, Zedekiah says. On the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe, we're back on 2 Kings, in the city, that there was no food for the people in the land. Apparently, this is how sieges worked. You know, the more we read this, I see it every time. A siege is basically a blockade. You know, starving them out. I guess they build the walls to theoretically go over. But why risk if you can just wait? I have all the food out here. They have to run out sooner or later. One of the things that made Jerusalem harder to do this to was they built the trenches and the tunnels to bring water in. And, you know, they're still there. You know, the underground source of water where you couldn't thirst them out. So it made it usually go longer. I think Hezekiah did that. I'm guessing. I made it up. Never mind. Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by night by the way of the gates between the two walls beside the king's garden. Through the Chaldeans were all around the city, and they went by the way of Arabah. So basically, the army ran away, leaving everybody else sort of like, uh-oh. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. And his army was scattered from him, and they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and he passed sentence on him. They slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, then put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. Which brings us to the point that I try to bring up. Because Jeremiah told Zedekiah that he would see Nebuchadnezzar. That's what Jeremiah prophesied. Ezekiel, who was also working the circuit, told him he wouldn't see Babylon. And both prophecies came true. So one says, you're going to see Nebuchadnezzar. And the other one says, but you won't see Babylon. So Jeremiah 34:3 said, you will not escape from his hand. You will surely be captured and delivered into his hand. And you will see the king of Babylon eye to eye. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And he will speak to you face to face. And you will go to Babylon. Ezekiel said, I will also spread my net out over him, and he will be caught in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, yet he will not see it, though he will die there. And you're going, oh? Now, verse 8 says, back on 2 Kings, now on the seventh day of the fifth month, which is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzarand, or whatever his name is, I better get this one right, he's in here a few times, Nebuzarand, that's what we're going to call him, and the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. He burned the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even the great houses, he burnt with fire. So Jerusalem is just being laid bare. They're just destroying it. They're not even trying to keep stuff anymore. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls all around Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon and the rest of the people, Nebuzaradan, captain of the guard, carried away into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. Once again, this is the second time we saw this happen. It's really a good move. You capture the ground. You might as well get something out of it. So you leave people behind who had nothing, and you tell them, it's all yours. And they're happy. Yeah, these people are, well, in theory, we'll see the theory doesn't always work. These people should never revolt. Their life just went, their stock just, it's like somebody sweeps through here and you got kicked out of your apartment and they moved you in on, you know, the penthouse downtown. You know, like, yeah, you can have that. And you're like, this is going to work. Then we're just talking about some of the stuff they took. Now the bronze pillars, which the house of the Lord, and the stands and the bronzes, which are in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried away to Babylon. This is the interesting part. They took the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, the spoons, and all the bronze vessels, which were used in the temple. All the stuff that the few times before this, when Jerusalem was sacked, they went and went, you know, we got all this other nicer stuff to take. They're taking everything. I mean, pots, spoons. I mean, sure, they're bronze, but you ask yourself, is it worth the trouble of carrying them all the way back to, right? The captain of the guard also took away the fire pans and the basins. What was fine gold and what was fine silver. There are two pillars, the one sea and the stands of Solomon made by the house of the Lord. The bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. The weight of one pillar, the height of one pillar was 18 cubits and a bronze capital was on it. They're taking away the actual columns. They're just taking it all. And the second pillar was like these with network. The captain of the guard took Sariah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, and three officers of the temple. So he sacked the temple. He took the guys that were in charge of the temple. From the city, he took one official, who was the overseer of men of war, which would be, best way to put it, would be the Secretary of Defense. Found him and five of the king's advisors, which would be the cabinet, who were found in the city, and the scribe of the captains of the army who mustered the people of the land, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found in the city. Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. The king of Babylon struck them down and put them to death at Riblah at the land of Hamath. So Judah was led away into exile from its land. The Book of Lamentations records Jeremiah's sorrow over this. When you read Lamentations, it's about this. They'll give you some perspective. But they now cease to exist. I mean, there's a remnant, and there's still a little more to say, but Judah's gone, Israel's gone, and now it's just in other people's hands. And God had told them this was going to happen. God told them, don't resist it. I'm the one doing this. Remember, he called Nebuchadnezzar my servant, and nobody's going to stop my servant because of everybody. He couldn't find anyone in Israel to listen to him as well as the heathen from Babylon Nebuchadnezzar was doing. It does not bode well. Now for the people who were left in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left, he appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of that guy, over them, and all the captains of the forces, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah governor, and they came to a whole bunch of people, Bob, Bill, Frank, and all these people. Gedaliah swore to them and their men and said to them, do not be afraid to serve the Chaldeans. Live in the land and serve the king of Babylon and it will be well with you. Which is what God had said through the prophets. He's not just placating. He's not just trying to keep peace because Nebuchadnezzar put him in charge. like, okay, I'm in charge. I don't need a problem here. Much like Herod, the problem he had trying to keep people under so that the Romans wouldn't do things. This is the same thing. Let's not tick him off and give him a reason to come back here. He knows what the Lord said. The Lord said, Nebuchadnezzar's coming. Go serve him. Don't fight this because you're not going to win. He knows that. Jeremiah 49 says, "And Gedaliah, the son of Achim, son of Shaphan, swore to them, to their men, saying, do not be afraid of serving the Chaldeans. Stay in the land and serve the king of Babylon. It may go well with you." That's a quote. He's quoting what the prophet said. So he obviously knows. Back to 2 Kings. But it came about in the seventh month that Ishmael, son of Nathaniah, the son of, Elishem, the royal family, came with 10 men and struck Gedaliah down so that he died along with the Jews, and the Chaldeans were with him at Mizpah. So, what this is saying is, the dude that Nebuchadnezzar left in charge of Israel, people in Israel plotted against him, it says, of the royal family, people who thought they should have been in charge, came, killed him, and not only did he kill him, they killed other Israelis. Not only did they kill them, they killed some of Nebuchadnezzar's people. And that doesn't go well. You know, that just, what are they thinking? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar showed up and crushed the entire army, and they're just this little remnant. And I don't know what the point of this is, but anyway. And I'm sure they put a spiritual purpose behind this. I'm sure, let's remove the infidels from our land and yada, yada, yada. Forgetting that God said, don't do this. What God wants, he doesn't want your opinions. He wants obedience. And if they would have been obedience, this would have went a whole lot better. Now, sure, it's not what anybody wanted, but God said, this is what's happening. Deal with it. And there are times in all of our lives where, God, this isn't what I want. Yeah, but this is what's happening. Deal with it, you know, and deal with it right. You know, give me, put your heart into it because I said so. It's the biggest because I said so there is, and it makes sense. In Jeremiah 10:40, he tells this account. Now, as for me, behold, I'm going to stay at Mizpah. This is the dude that they left behind saying that, to stand for you before the Chaldeans who has come to us. But as for you, gather in wine and summer and fruit and oil and put them in storage vessels, live in your cities and that you have taken over. So this is the guy left in charge talking to the people of Israel saying, I'll deal with Nebuchadnezzar's problems. You guys, go enjoy your life. He says, whatever he put you in charge of, go enjoy it. Your life's better than it was before. I'll handle the problems. This is like a cool thing to say. You don't have to worry about anything. I got this. I'll bear the burden. Go live your life. Enjoy yourself. However, obviously not enough. In 40, 13 through 16, now Joanna, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces that were in the field came to Gedaliah at Mizpah and said to him, are you aware that Belias, the king and the sons of Ammon, had sent Ishmael, the son of Nathaniah, to take your life? But Gilgal said to Achaim and did not believe them. So he gets a heads up. He says, listen, this Ishmael is coming to kill you because the Ammonites are behind this. The indigenous people who have been a problem to Israel from the time they left Egypt because they didn't do what they were told to do. When you go into the land, okay, Israel is gone now, and they're still bothering them. Before they went into the land, the Lord said, go in and wipe them out. The reason I gave you that land is because they were so bad, they needed to be dealt with. If you will remember, when the famine came and Jacob's sons went to Egypt and encountered Joseph and brought Israel out of there, all of Israel went out of there and came into Egypt, the reason was is to kill those people in there because they were so rotten. I mean, let's not forget this. So God said, when you go in there, I want them all dead. I don't want you making treaties with them. Well, they didn't listen. And it says, if you don't, you will do the things they do, you will sin the sins they sin, and I will have to send you into exile. It all happened. Here we are. And the Ammonites are still bothering them. There's like 20 of them left. And it's just, it's a passion with them. So the guy gets a heads up saying, the Ammonites are trying to get this guy who has royal lineage to come and kill you. And here's his response. But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son said to Joanna, the son of Kareah, do not do this thing, for you are telling me a lie about Ishmael. Obviously, he knows Ishmael, and they are somewhat close. And as always, it's the close guy that gets you, et tu, Brute. You know, if you ever saw 3 Days of the Condor where Max von Sydow explains how they're going to kill him, it'll be somebody you know. He'll give you a warm smile, a come here smile, before he kills you. And this guy is saying, he gets a heads up and he goes, nah, I don't believe it. Just stop saying that stuff. You know, you're causing a problem. So then in Jeremiah 41, 1 through 3, in the seventh month, Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of that person in the royal family and one of the chief officers of the king, along with 10 men, came to Mizpah to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, while they were eating bread together at Mizpah. Ishmael, the son of that guy, and the 10 men who were with him, arose and struck down Gedaliah and the son of Ahikam and the son of, with a sword and put him to death, and the ones who the king of Babylon had appointed over the land, Ishmael, all struck down, all the Jews who were with him, that is with Gedaliah at Mizpah, and the Chaldeans who were there, the men of war. You can imagine this didn't go well with Nebuchadnezzar. Then all the people, both great and small, the captains of the forces, arose, went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. So what this is saying is they ran and killed him and ran away and left everybody else to bear the burden of what was coming. They went to Egypt. I'm assuming there's a reason for this, you know, that one I don't understand. I don't know if it's resentment over the not being in the royal family or if it's just the Ammonites paid them. It said it enticed them. I don't know what that means. No, it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, that evil Merodach, that's his actual name. It's like Evil Knievel, but yeah. And he was in there from 560. He was only 2 years, 562 to 560. King of Babylon, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. He spoke kindly to him and set the throne above the thrones of the kings who were with him at Babylon. Jehoiakim changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life for his allowance. A regular allowance was given him by the king, a portion of the day.
Dude.
In all of his life. So what we end up with is they're all gone. But in the end, we see God has never lost his eye on Israel. He knows exactly where they are. He knows exactly what they're doing. I think it was, is it Isaiah or Jeremiah? Or we always get that, that verse of verses that just gets quoted all the time. I know what plans I have for you, plans to prosper you, not to harm you. And we go, yeah, yeah. And remember when it says, but for 70 years, she will go into exile. That's what the verse before it was. That's what we're talking about. God's saying, don't complain, it's me. You're going to be hauled away into captivity for 70 years. But I know what plans I have for you, plans to prosper you. And we don't see that. You know, things happen. Let's just take the job, for instance. And by no means, let's say she doesn't get the job. God knows exactly what he's doing. We have to learn that. We learn our faith. There's faith that for the moment that God will just thrust into your heart because he knows that you're not going to learn it in time. Nah, that ain't ever going to happen. So the Holy Spirit just gives you the faith for the moment to do what's right in front of you. But that does not take away from the faith that is yours. That other faith is the faith of God that he gives you to handle the moment. The faith that is yours that you have learned. You've learned it by failing. You've learned it by doing. And then years later, seeing that God's hand was in it. And you say to yourself, wow, that was God. And it wasn't pleasant, but it was good. That's how you learn faith. And God is patient to allow us to learn it that way. And Israel had a real hard time with it. When this book started, we opened with Elijah being taken to heaven. And it ends with Judah being taken into captivity. Both are being taken away. They're the two possibilities in this life. you will either be taken to heaven or you will be held captive to this earth. Those are what the cards you're dealt. There are no others. Oh. Christine Miller. Oh, I'll wait till after. So, any questions, comments, interesting things about 2 Kings, 1 Kings, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel? Because Israel's gone. And anything, anybody about the whole venture of Israel? Any questions, comments, criticisms, anything like that? Cool. Now, I at least want to get started. We're going to jump ahead a little while here, about 100 years, into captivity. Babylon's gone. The Persians have taken over. And I think I said it last week. We have a hard understanding. And, you know, you got to keep remembering what's going on here. The Assyrians first took Israel. The Babylonians came and took Judah. Persians came and took everybody. The Babylonians, you in your mind, we always think of them as the great empire. Hold on. Okay, stop. All right. Almost sneezed. Because we have so much information on them. So much is written about Nebuchadnezzar, you would think, but actually of the three empires, they were just sort of the smallest ones. And the Persians just came in and they just owned from Egypt to India. When, you know, that 300 movie that was out, that's the Persians. That's, you know, Marathon. What's that battle of anyway, all the big battles, all that stuff. This what comes up out of them is the Greek Empire, the father of Alexander the Great, you know, and we're heading towards, and after that, the Romans and then Jesus Christ. So I just want you to get a little big picture of what's going on, and God's using the whole thing. And I think it was Daniel's vision. Where he see, and it's so cool because in Daniel's vision, where he talks about the statue, they have that disturbing dream, and there's that statue with the feet of this and the thighs of that, and a hunk of a mountain came down and broke the feet out, and Daniel just said, and he just everything I just said, he just names them right through. This is what that vision means, and this is who's going to come and do what, and that's exactly what happened. It's just God knew the whole time, you know, and people think they're controlling the world, and they're not, you know, they're just. God lets them play. And that's pretty much it. So what we're doing is we are now in the Persian Empire. Go ahead.
Before that, how many years was Samuel 1 through Kings?
I wrote that down. Believe it or not,
I think you said that.
Yeah. At some point. Right. What I did is Solomon, which is the last of the unified empire, just to give a frame of reference from somewhere we've been recently. Samuel 1, it's before they became a nation. Samuel's the one that brought Saul. Remember, it was Saul, David, Solomon. They only lasted 3 kings. Yeah, 3 kings. Solomon was 971 to 931. And Esther is 483. So just from Solomon, we've come a long way. 500 years. And then going back to, well, three generations takes you back to Saul. So you're probably adding, what, another 150 years, maybe, tops. So I guess we're looking at about 650 years. It would be just a way to figure it, because First Samuel starts with Saul becoming king and the people having problems, right? So, go ahead, honey. No, that's, jump in.
And are the 100 years that we're skipping covered somewhere else?
Yeah. There were three returns. I have this here, from exile, and I haven't. I get that.
Cool.
But the reason I went here is just because this is such a neat account, just for some perspective. Oh, by the way, this is when Confucius and Buddha are walking the earth. I remember I said that. I wasn't sure which it was. This time, this is what's going on in the world. Old Esther's up there in captivity. They've been in captivity so long, they're assimilated. The Jews never really assimilate anywhere. They maintain who they are, and that's a neat thing. We're talking quite a bit of time, and the Persians defeated the Athenians, the Spartans defeated the Persians, Assyrian Empire runs from 900, I mean, not that, but down to 612. So the Assyrians run almost 300 years of stuff. That's 700, 612. Then Babylonians are 612 to 539, and Persians run from 539 BC to 330 BC. The Persians run the world for a while. The word Esther is a Persian for star. And Hebrew named is Hadassah, which means myrtle. I don't know. That's supposed to be. I don't know what myrtle is. I've never seen a myrtle. I don't know what they are. It's a plant. I don't know if it's pretty. I don't know if it's a bush. I know there's a beach. And this book is the basis for the Jewish festival of Purim, P-U-R-I-M, which is still part of their culture and their tradition. It is not a legal given by God festival. It's not Passover. It's not any of those things. It's celebrated on the 14th day of Adar, which is usually in March. It's a joyous celebration that is initiated by Mordecai, who is one of the players here. The word Purim means lots, which is how Haman determined the date the Jews were to be killed, preceded by a minor fast, the fast of Esther. They read in the book of Esther, and here's what they do when they do it. They read the book of Esther during this festival, and whenever they mention his name, they boo. Like, the family will say, boo, you know, just, yeah. And then gifts are given. And this is what's interesting about this. The song, like the Song of Solomon, there's no mention of God. There are no, I like this, because there are no miracles in the sky. There are no seas parting. There's, you know, the sun doesn't stand still. This is just people dealing with what's in front of them. Which has pretty much been my life. I've never seen a sea part. I've never, you know, I know God's here. I know he's real. His power is used for the things he wants him to use for. And we've talked about this before. When there has been great outpourings of the power of God, it's because something was happening. It happened with the law. It happened when Jesus Christ came. It happened when the law came. It happened when salvation by grace came. And also happened to prove when people were God's spokesman. That's the purposes of miracles. There are no miracles here. None that other than God working how God works. This is as close to our lives as I can get in the Old Testament. It's just people living their lives, being messed with. There's no deep prayers, but God sees, God intercedes. It's God working in life. There's also no mention of God in Song of Solomon, which is kind of neat. We have gone from the Assyrian kingdom, where the northern kingdom was taken away, to the Babylonians, took the southern kingdom. Now the Persians have inherited the Jewish exiles and the Babylonians. These events take place between the first and second Jewish return to Israel, under Zerubbabel, the second under Ezra, the third under Nehemiah. So it's between the second and third. Three times they're allowed to come back and establish something there. Nehemiah is just the neatest one. You know, it's just such a neat book to read. And so there are some Jewish people back in Israel at this time. They've been allowed to go back. Nehemiah, was it Ezra and Nehemiah that started to build the wall again, started to build the temple, started to make it a city, started to make Jerusalem a city again. These things are all going on. While she's up there, obviously unaffected by what's being written in the other books at this time. What's the events that are being written in these other books, Ezra and Nehemiah, are apparently not affecting her. She's just living her life. She's just a Jewish kid living under Babylonian rule. Been under it so long, it's just you know, that I just get up, go to work today and do whatever I got to do. The dislike, now there's two people in here. There's a dislike between Mordecai and Haman. Most of the problems that arise here are because of the dislike these two have for each other. Mordecai is a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin. Who else was from the tribe of Benjamin? Does anybody remember who was from the tribe of Benjamin? His name starts with Saul. And we had all that trouble between David and Judah and with the tribe of Benjamin. He always had trouble with those people from Benjamin. He would always go out of his way. Well, this is who Mordecai is. Hey, a lot of years have passed, okay, from that. They never forget. They never forget. Now, Haman, one is an Agite, and this problem goes back 1,000 years. You know how they still hate each other now because of stuff that happened in the Bible? That was going on long before now. When the Jews were leaving Egypt, they were harassed by the Amalekites. The Amalekites were Esau's grandsons. If you remember who Agag was, he was the Amalekite king that Saul spared. When Samuel said, "Why do I hear sheep?" When, "Oh, the people told me." And he says, "Why is that guy still alive? Did I not tell you to kill him?" And Samuel drew his sword and killed Agag. This guy is his descendant. The other guy is Saul's descendant. And they still blame Saul for capturing and then letting Samuel kill him. So 1,000 years. We're talking a long time. All the way back to when Israel was entering the promised land. There was hardship between these two. Haman is the descendant of Agag, and Mordecai is the descendant of Saul. 550 years later, they still don't like each other. This may be why Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman, and why Haman wants to exterminate the Jews. That's just a little background, and we'll just get a little bit of time. Now, it took place on the day of Ahasuerus, which is Xerxes. One's their name, the other's the Greek name. And Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, the king Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which is the citadel of Susa. It's the king's winter residence. He has four capitals. He's got so much, he just picks a capital and goes there for a while. In the third year of the reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants and the army officers of Persia and the Medes. It's all one kingdom, but they split the kingdom. They call them the Persians and the Medes. But it is all one group. It'd be like the Pennsylvanians and the Ohioans. I don't know how else to put it. But you'll hear it a lot. You'll hear them called the Medes. But it's all just Persians. The nobles and the princes of his provinces were in his presence. We're talking about 483 BC. That's the year they're saying this is happening. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for as many days, 180 days. So this dude throws a 6-month party. Just because he wants to. I'm that filthy rich. And he is. All that stuff is sending money to him. From Egypt to India, it's all funneling to him. When these days were complete, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. So at the end of the six-month party, he throws a banquet for all the people who were present at the citadel at Susa, from the greatest to the least. Everybody comes, the garbage collector, the mayor, everybody, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white, violet linen held by the cords, fine purple and silver rings and marble columns, the couches of gold and silver, and the mosaic pavement of the, whatever that is, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Porphyry? I don't know what that is. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds. The royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. And I love this line from verse 8. The drinking was done according to the law. Think about it. Was it a command to go drink? But anyway, whatever that was, there was no compulsion. Usually you don't need compulsion to have people drink, but for so the king had given the order to each official in his household that he should do according to the desires of each person, which is kind of a cool thing. What he's saying is this is my big party, but if you don't want to come and party with me, okay, that's fine. Queen Vashti, who gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which also belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, about Vashti. The Greek name was Amestris, which means strong woman. She is said to have caused the wife of her brother-in-law to be mutilated. Herodotus wrote that. Twice she had 7 noble Persians boy buried alive as a sacrifice to the god of the netherworld. This is coming from Greek historians. She died at an old age towards the end of Artaxerxes' reign. According to an Oriental fairy tale reproduced by Herodotus, she was a very jealous woman. When Xerxes returned from his Greek war, he fell in love with the wife of one of his sons. In return for her favor, she demanded a special cloak that she had made for Xerxes. So, he has an affair with the wife of his son, and she says, give me the coat that your wife made for you, which is really a bad idea. And then she wears it. When the queen saw her daughter-in-law parading around in, well, the stuff that she had given him, she knew what was going on and ordered her mother to be mutilated. Because of that, Xerxes' brother decided to revolt against the king and brother and was not successful. So this is just some idea of what is known about her, some of which may be embellished, but she is, the Greeks are writing about her after these events. So she's a hitter. I mean, she's a heavy hitter. People know who she is. She's a player. She's not just somebody who comes out and dances. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he was snookered. He commanded, and you know, nothing good happens when you're drunk. Mahanam and this whole group of people that I'm not going to name, and seven eunuchs who served the presence of the king, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and princes, for she was very beautiful. So he's sitting there drunk with all of his buddies. And they're all sitting there after, a six-month party and a seventh-day festival. And he's just slobber-knocked. And they're all sitting around and he goes, go get my wife and tell her to come here. And not a good idea. But, you know, I guess when you're the king, you can do this stuff. I mean, this wouldn't, come on, baby. Make yourself pretty, little darling. Yeah, and, she doesn't go for this, but Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. When the king became very angry, his wrath burned with him. There has been some speculation at that time that she may have even been pregnant at that time with Artaxerxes, their son, which, if you've ever been around a pregnant woman, they're not up for this sort of thing. They're not happy, and we'll just leave it at that. When the king said to the wise men who understood the times, I love this. He sends for them. They're all drunk. Oh, wait till you see how pretty my wife is. Hey, honey, put on something skimpy and come out here and stand in front of us. And she goes, are you crazy? That ain't happening. And so he gets really mad. And so he turns to the people who were wise and understood the times. For it was the custom of the king so to speak before all who had law and justice. So what he says to him is, he finds people who know the law and say, what can I do about this? My wife didn't listen to me. And we're close to him. And it names them again. According to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not obey the command of the king Ashuras delivered by the eunuchs. In the presence of the king and the princess, Menachem said, Queen Vashti was wrong. Not only the king, but also the princes and all the people who were in the provinces of Ashur. So basically, she offended everybody. The entire country's offended. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ashurus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in his presence, and she didn't come. In other words, flashback to Blazing Saddles. Mel Brooks and all the harump men are standing there, and he says, what are we going to do? We're going to lose our phony baloney jobs. We have to do something because we're going to lose credibility here. So they all get together and says, oh no, I can't let my wife hear this. If Vashti's doing this, I'm going to go home, and my wife's going to say to me, no. And we have to harump, harump. You know, I didn't get a rump out of that guy. We have to come up with something here to nip it in the bud, Andy. That's what they're saying. This, we cannot, you think, with an entire empire, this is what they're putting their collective legal minds to. Uh-oh, the women are rebelling. And because she didn't want to dance and, whatever. This day, the ladies of Persia and Media, who have heard the queen's conduct, will speak in the same way to all the king's princes. And there will be plenty of contempt and anger. As if there wasn't contempt and anger before. It will be displayed. Of course they weren't happy. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of the Persians and the Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come to the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. When the king's edict, which he will make is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. I don't know if you could actually legally make someone honor someone, but the boys are trying. You know, them boys are out there pitching. And you would think with the Greeks and the rise of the Macedonians and everything else, this is what the boys are worried about. Because she says no, the entire kingdom is in, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? This word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Ma'akim proposed. And so his letter went to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, to every person according to their language. Dude, they nailed this one. From India to Ethiopia, women, you have to listen to your husbands. That's basically what this says. They translated it into everything they could, that every man should be the master of his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Everybody in this kingdom, this is how it has to be. And, you know, you can make all those edicts all you want. Who runs the house is who runs the house. There ain't nothing you can do about it. And all because of this. And because of this, God knows what he's doing. Something really cool happens. We'll end here. But there's this little teenage girl walking around, just minding her own business, bothering nobody, doesn't know any of this stuff's going on, out tending the sheep, whose life is about to be changed big time. And, you know, once again, apparently, as Scripture says, she's an extremely beautiful young lady. And I'll say it once again, just be careful what you ask for. You know, because, man, every time we talk about a beautiful young lady, oh, just stuff happens. You know, either to her or the people around her or the people, you know, it's just, yeah, we'll just leave it at that. Then we'll pick up on chapter 2.